Mental peace often eludes us. There's chatter and noise in our minds. Our brains are like an old-fashioned car radio between stations. If you've only traveled in the age of digital splitting, you probably don't remember how radio dials used to be able to be placed between stations, and you could get some exquisite mixes of two or more stations, maybe three if you were lucky. And you could get sports, music, and radio preachers all fading in and out and speaking over top of one another. So fly balls would be mixed with sin and country music, and it would be pretty funny, actually. I'd do it deliberately. But our brains can be like that, and that's not funny. And all the while, just like on the old radio dial, there'd be some static in the background, just enough to annoy you. But occasionally it would spike for some reason or another, and then you'd jump. Our thoughts don't settle easily. I'm not talking about mental illness here. I'm speaking of what I think is normal human experience, as I know it anyway. And oddly, it seems that people sometimes find just being alone, then without distractions, can be a little unsettling because they've filled their quiet spaces with TV and radio and communication. They've kept busy and then hoped that that would take care of their thought lives. But to see when they're alone and quiet or forced to be in that situation, they're unsettled because suddenly the noise in their own mind gets louder. So it's no wonder, I think this is, as I said, normal human experience, it's no wonder that an age-old practice in the church, a spiritual practice, is to be silent and to be alone. And if you're like me and you've tried it, you find you're not very good at it. You see, I'm a real extrovert. I like it where the lights are on. It energizes me. And though I fear mobs deeply, I kind of like crowds. I like watching people. I like listening to them. And I like it where there's lots of motion and activity. And you see, that's why downtown London really unsettles me. Because speaking of frequencies, it must be there at some real low frequency, but nobody's told me how to tune in yet, Kenneth. I'm just not got the frequency for downtown London. It's quiet. It seems like things should be going on. Things should be happening. But the streets are deserted like there's been an evacuation and they didn't give me the memo or something. A few minutes of mental peace can go a long way towards making you a happier person, making you even physically healthier for that matter, because it gives you a clearer picture. That clear picture is worth so much to you, so more than all your money. A few minutes of peace and life comes into focus, and it's that focus and that clarity that lead to such good things. I'll illustrate this way. When I was a young, poor musician, and then afterwards I became a not quite so young, poor pastor, but in any event, I was poor in both cases, and so I was driving some real remarkable automobiles, and often had to do my own car work, which was a fine idea except for a drawback, which is I don't know anything about cars, or at least I didn't at the time. And so there with my Chilton's manual in a friend's garage or on the carport covered with oil and grease, I would sit and then try to dive in. And sometimes, well, actually a lot of the times, I just didn't get it. I didn't understand how on earth you were even supposed to reach this or that part. For some reason, it wouldn't loosen the way they said that it should in the manual. And a lot of times I couldn't even find it when I was looking at things. What I finally learned to do, though, was walk away. Not permanently, of course. That would have been a cute trick. But what I finally learned to do is leave the garage and go sit down, have a cup of tea or whatever I could get, and chill out for a minute or two. And then I would come back, and somehow or other, what had been cloudy became clear. A few moments of peace, a few moments of clarity, took care of the major part of the problem. I couldn't see what was wrong. I couldn't see what I was doing wrong. Well, I think it's a picture of life in larger terms, and I think our lives are like that. We lose our focus. We lose ourselves. We lose the big picture. We just can't see things. And so I think we ought to think about this in big terms. In other words, who was it I wanted to be in life? What kind of person did I want to become? And what kind of person am I? What really matters to me when all is said and done? What are my goals? What are my priorities? And have I forgotten my own standards Am I destined to just follow this jabber, this radio station in my mind with whatever went through my brain last? And must I, by doing that, sink to a lower and lower place, or at least end up in a place I never had intended to go? Is there a way back then to a bigger person, a better person, something more, something good, something on track, something I respect? Well, you see how this works. As I said, I like it downtown where it's always loud. I like music within some markers. I like parties. But a voice often calls me to consider solitude and quiet for my own well-being, to shut up for once, to go away from, not into activity or a party or a discussion. And sometimes if you can do it, you need to get away from all activity. Even churches do this to you. They fill too much noise into your mind. You'll remember after John the Baptist was executed, Jesus and the disciples got away. Mark 6 tells us, he said to them, "Come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest a while." There were so many coming and going that they did not even have time to eat. I think you can picture a week or two like that. Now, most of us have to carve out a few moments of a day. It might be nice to think that we could create now, and I would have said this, there's usually an overachiever in the audience who is now beginning to plan out a rigorous program of spiritual retreats and rigorous discipline. But believe me, for most of us, that isn't going to work. The opportunity won't be there. It will be occasional at best. For the average person in the average life, I think most Christians carve this space out for them with some prayer and Bible reading as their most basic spiritual discipline, the one that's easiest to get to, and can serve to quiet the mind the way I'm speaking. Every Christian should carve out some of that time for themselves every day. And most, I know, find it difficult, at least at times in life. Now, why do you do that? Well, in part, because our minds are noisy and because we want mental peace. We want that peace of God. Jesus said he would give peace, that he would leave us with peace. The Bible puts a high priority on the idea of a peace that passes all understanding. And it really goes hand in hand with simply being a Christian, doesn't it? We surrender our lives to Christ and we find peace. But then sometimes we have to ask, well, what happened to it? And what can we do to cooperate with the process or bring it back? The passage I'd like to look at is in Philippians. I'm going to make the bold suggestion you don't look it up, though, but that you listen to it. Ask my students sometime why I ask you to do that. But it's in chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. The reference is in your bulletin. The passage. "Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. The things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you." Finally. That's the first word in the set of verses. It's the first word here. When "finally" appears in the fourth chapter of a book that has four chapters, you think of it as something that just couldn't be left out. In a sense, it's the capstone of what everything that was said leads to this point. It follows everything. It finishes the letter. Until this was said, until this was summarized, there was no sense of completion. And so it's an important set of verses. That follow a "finally." And then we get this long list of whatever things, not whatever the way we use it so often, whatever in the sense of very specific things. Specific in a sense. In one sense, you would say there were too many examples, too many situations to pin it down. Paul doesn't give you any easy examples of what he's talking about. And I think that's because the list of whatever things is meant to be flexible. It applies in many ways. It applies to you. So it's thrown into the ball is thrown into your court, you may say, here. Where are these things, these whatever things, to be found in your world? What can you look at that matches the whatever things? The Bible assumes they are there and that you can recognize them. Now, depending on how you add up the list, there could be 6 or 8 items on it. The first element is whatever things are true. Being truthful without bending the story at all is one of the toughest assignments you can be offered in life. And we're not talking here as an exhortation not to cheat on your taxes or something like that. And do these jeans make me look fat jokes and things like that. I don't think we're talking about a kind of scrupulosity or a commitment against blatant lying. I think what we're driving at is being committed to living according to the truth and not convenient lies. And this is a first line commitment for a Christian. Now, for the record, it's not surprising that we find this very difficult to do. We're not honest with others, often because we're not honest with ourselves. We don't like telling ourselves the truth, frankly, at least not the unvarnished truth. A life committed to truth can be kind of inconvenient at times. We live in constant denial, as said, of what's at the end of our own fork. Truth can be exhausting. But truth sets us free according to Jesus. Facing the whole picture of life with uncompromising honesty seems to be a necessary condition for coming to Christ in the first place. I don't think we're talking about that commitment necessarily here, but you see how it works. Honesty is a prerequisite. Now, what do we do with this call to the truth? Well, you jump ahead of the list of whatever things. We have to jump ahead of 6 elements here or 7 elements here and find that Paul doesn't really tell us, well, commit yourself to this. Get ready to work. Buckle down. Get serious. Roll up your sleeves. Get real. You've been a lazy slouch. Shake it off. Cry baby. Commit yourself to the truth. Get on with it. Well, what does he say? He says something really gentle. He says, meditate on these things. You have to see the list of whatever things, including truth, the first element, you have to see it before you can commit yourself to it. You have to hold the picture up. You need to let it come into focus and ponder it. You need to trade in first reactions, which are often just sloppy and poorly formulated, and think of what your third and fourth, your later reactions to things are. You could illustrate this many ways. I was thinking as I was looking at it, that when you buy things online, if you buy merchandise, usually at a site like that, won't they have a little picture of whatever it is you want to buy, and they'll say, click to enlarge this view. Well, I always do, of course. And sometimes there are other views. You can see whatever you're buying from different angles. And sometimes you can even switch the colors, and that's really magical. You know, you can turn it from black to red or whatever. Well, as I see it, to meditate on truth is to click on it, to enlarge the view, and to click on the other views and get them. And it means to get up and walk away and come back and click on it again sometime and look at it many times and think about it before you do anything. So I don't think we give the list of whatever things, whether we start with truth or the list that follows, I don't think we give that proper attention when earbuds are in or our phone is on and texts are roaring in, Facebook is open, the TV or radio is on. I think in order to do this, we need quiet space and exclusive attention. Then you are meditating, not until then. Element 2, whatever things are noble. I love the word noble. It sounds old-fashioned, and I see knights on chargers in armor. And it's always shiny armor, of course. Depending on your translation, you might see the term pure or honorable. And I suppose pure and honorable are synonyms in a sense with the word noble. You can pick up any Bible dictionary and read the nuances of a Greek word that would be translated here. They'll tell you more than you want to know. Some of them will suggest that this word noble is majestic, splendid, or at least the things that are worthy of reverence as being somehow majestic. But I love the term noble. I have seen a lot of the opposite of noble, ignoble, in myself. those times when I wasn't exactly a knight in shining armor, not even close. So it seems like noble gives me a picture to reach for, something honorable, something splendid. Whatever things are just, you might have the word right here. And once again, it's about the same. I suppose right and just are the same, but I think we tend to reduce this term to right conduct for us personally, as it doesn't affect other people. But in fact, being just is all about other people, doing right by other people, right in situations. And if you don't take time to meditate on what that would mean ahead of time, or take time to review it after it happens, then I think you're likely to act unjustly. If we hope that moral intuition and instinct take over in a critical situation, we're dreaming. If you're mad or threatened, you have voices either whispering in your ear or shouting in your ear, you might well make a choice you regret. And later, I hope you do, reflect on it and say, I wasn't fair. I wasn't just. I wasn't right. I was defending the indefensible. I didn't defend the weak. I didn't guard a person's dignity. I acted from selfishness or fear. Well, you see, a little meditation on this helps you to clear the picture and give you a better view. The next one on the list is also intriguing to me. Whatever things are lovely. Lovely things are agreeable, but in particular, they're pleasing to look at. They're attractive. This is the only place in the New Testament that this word appears. I wonder, though, since lovely seems to be something we all know, have you ever had the experience of rethinking lovely? You saw something and you found it lovely at first, but then you cooled on it for some reason or another. Maybe it was the boy or girl you were madly in love with in sixth grade, I don't know. Maybe a man and woman later in life. You thought over it and it wasn't so lovely after all. Or a house or a car that you wasn't so lovely on second thought. Some reflection made you reconsider the situation. Once again, time and meditation cause you to see perhaps lovely in something you overlooked and didn't regard as lovely, or to reconsider something you did think was lovely and turns out not to be that way. Just as absolutely unsolicited and gratuitous advice for you here. As you grow older, your taste will change considerably, and frankly, it will get better if you applied yourself at all. You will find all kinds of lovely and things you didn't think were lovely, and find all kinds of things you thought were lovely, you no longer think so. Whatever things are of good report. This is another word that appears only here in the New Testament. Now, it's true that the crowd, of course, can be wrong. A good report or a good reputation isn't always to be taken at face value, but it would be foolish to jump to the other extreme and ignore what was held up as being good. But there's some technical discussion about this word, actually. It's not to be understood in the passive sense of merely things that are spoken well of, but in the sense of those things that speak well for themselves. Not that sound good, oh, that merely sounds good, but that sounds good. It speaks well of itself. It's nice to listen to. And then he says, if there is any virtue, the list changes here. And this term seems to be the summary word of the list. All of the above, the things we've just mentioned, those things that are true, noble, lovely, of good report, these are mentioned as virtues. Virtue is a powerful word with a very strong history, interestingly, in the pagan world that Paul was writing to in a city like Philippi, or at least the people had come out of that pagan world. Virtue has a long lineage in Greek and Roman culture. Establishing virtues, it was thought, was what led to a good life and happiness. What are you about? Well, becoming a virtuous person, acquiring the virtues. And then you had a good life, and then you were satisfied. Not happiness in the dim bulb sense of a smile on your face all the time, but happiness in the sense of deeply content. This has to do with excellence, merit, and achievement. It's acquired over time. It's acquired by practice. It's acquired by meditation. And it seems that Paul was pretty bluntly saying here, probably to his audience in a way that's lost on us, the pagans don't own this idea. This idea belongs to God. Virtue leads to happiness. If there's anything worthy of praise, this is the famous hypothetical question. Of course there is something worthy of praise. A human being's a praising fool. You know this. It's our nature to declare things for what they are, to enjoy and call attention to those things that we all consider excellent. I mean, it's rare to find a person who isn't just wired that way. If they see something they think is deserving of attention, they call you over to come and look at it and see it. And you naturally praise those things that you love, that you regard as excellent or beautiful. So in short, Paul says, meditate on that which is virtuous and praiseworthy. Let your mind dwell on it. Meditation requires time. It requires space. But it pays you back wonderfully. I am no paragon of this. I preach to myself as I speak this. But even a little bit of time brings order back to the noisy brain. And it's not merely a human exercise in mental hygiene. That's the point of the next verse. It's a spiritual room where God meets you. Verse 9 says, "The things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you." Now, we have only one way in our day and age of learning, receiving, and hearing about those things the Apostle Paul said and did, and that is by reading about them in the Bible. You'll know that Paul did not regard himself as a superior human being or someone who always did it right, but he did see himself as the guardian of a great treasure, revelations from God. I accept this. Those things we learn and receive and hear from him aren't human things. They were revealed to him from God. So when Paul says, the peace of God will be with you, well, this is not the wishful thinking of an inflated ego. God meets us in these things. Meditate on these things. We face a great struggle in life not to degenerate. We get that way. To become less than what we respect. We need every tool, every weapon that can be used to keep it from happening. Meditate on these things is something we can do. Now, as I said, the overachievers are already got a plan that they can't hold going through their mind. I'm not suggesting it. We're all prone to take the easiest route we can find. It's nice to know that in a world where everything changes, you can count on humans taking the easy way out, and that's good. There's nothing wrong with that. You might say there's actually something wrong with someone who won't do that, you know, why they have to do it the hard way. I can be one of those, for some reason, do it the hard way kind of guys, and I never wonder, well, what's driving me at that point? A very good question to ask anybody is, what are you trying to prove? And I've found usually the answer to that question is uncomfortable for everyone concerned. You might not know what you're trying to prove, but laziness, of course, is another matter, and there is much in our world that will make us mentally lazy. Entertainment nonstop would be one of them. Noise and gadgetry, and mind you, I love entertainment, noise and gadgetry and all those things, but I see, though, how they can work against me, at least at times. Now, I am not at all one to romanticize the past. I don't want to go back. Not in my own life, let alone back a few generations. But I do believe that at least for people who weren't terribly poor and struggling, there was more mental room for thinking in days gone by. I think there was more mental space because of those kinds of things I mentioned. I can't prove it. I'll never be able to prove this, and maybe I'm just getting grumpy, but I think we're shallow, and I think we're getting shallower. We have no patience whatsoever. No patience even in entertainment, which drives us all the time. I mean, you know how this goes in a film. You know, in an explosion, a car chase in the first 5 minutes of film, or 5 minutes. That's way too long, I think, by a producer's... you need a cadaver or two. Let's just face it. I mean, that's what we need. And a book, if you have the time, you know, if you're even willing to read, a book better get off to a pretty dramatic start by overstatement, or it's boring. It's by our current standards, of course, most of the world's classics are just boring. And you can read about how our national pastime is now considered boring. You know, football and basketball are much more active, appeal to the modern mind and mentality. You read analysis of soccer, for example. What's too boring for Americans? There's not enough scoring. You see, everything we do needs to feed our frenzy for faster and easier adrenaline to come at us. Well, you see how this could work against us in meditate on these things. Well, I recommend we try to make space. Now, of course, I recommend not being an overachiever. Maybe you want to send yourself into the woods now for 3 weeks to live on berries just to clear your mind. It might work. God bless you. But why not just take some time to read the Bible and pray and remove the props that bring noise and send your thoughts down predictable channels? And after your prayer, sit for a moment and meditate on whatever things. You know, we could do this in our worship services instead of rushing to the next element. Now, if you like props, go for it. But get some new ones, please. The evangelical church has depleted the world of props that have led people into meditation. Well, you don't need my suggestions. I mean, you could follow your inclinations, but the ideas are pretty obvious. Pick a different place. Assume a different posture, kneeling or standing. Read a different set of verses. Try a prayer book. Let someone else try to articulate your thoughts in that sense, someone who's thought about the topic. Change the lighting. For heaven's sakes, even burn some incense. It could be quite biblical. But that stuff's just on the surface. What you need is a couple of minutes alone and quiet. I want more of this in my life. Maybe you do too. Be silent. Lift one of these virtues up in your mind and think about, where is this found in my world? How can I absorb it, feel it, enter it, participate in it? Whatever things are noble, just, pure, lovely, of good report, if there is any virtue, anything worthy of praise, then count on it. The peace of God will meet you there.